Scientific Imagination is part of the Future-Based platform. For more information, visit scientificimagination.org. Erik Laan is a space industry consultant, a technical specialist in optical science instrument satellite payloads, with system engineering experience in the field of space robotics and microgravity. His technical specialties are space system engineering, an example the science user mission requirements. Laan is founder of Ion Orbit, a company devoted to bringing developments in space exploration. In addition, he is one of the Space Cowboys, a radio program on BNR, a Dutch radio station, in which he brings the latest news on space and astronomy. Erik, thank you for being part of the project on Scientific Imagination.
Thank you, Sabine. Nice to be here.
Could you please give an introduction on your background and current occupation?
So I have my own company called Ion Orbit, which I started back in 2013, completely devoted to working in the space industry. Before that, I've worked for many years Airbus Defence and Space Netherlands in Leiden, and also at ESRON, which is the Space Research Organization in Utrecht. And also here where I live in Delft, TNO. TNO also has a big space department. And yeah, in 2013, I started my own company, Ion Orbit. So now it's 2020 and it's already 7 years and they've flown by.
And what was your biggest motivation to follow this path throughout your study and career?
Actually, before I started working, I did a master in physics. And yeah, even before that, I was very interested in space. As a little kid, I've been looking at the night sky together with my dad. It just spurred my imagination. I think up until the launch of Wibbo Ockels, the first Dutch astronaut back in 1985, that's what really triggered my interest. And also the Challenger accident a year after, when the Space Shuttle Challenger exploded and there was several lives lost. That also triggered me very much in learning more about what space is. And so, yeah, I started studying physics with that in mind. I was thinking, well, I want to work in the space industry. And many people also ask me, why didn't you study aerospace engineering in Delft? But yeah, I'm always more on the theoretical side. I'm not really a plane builder. So that's the reason I didn't do aerospace engineering.
Because you ended up also in engineering, right?
Yes. I ended up in engineering. Yes.
Yes.
But I mean, in engineering, there is also a spectrum of activities. I mean, you can do engineering really practical with tools and just cutting the metal and really with your hands doing stuff. But there is also the starting point of engineering is come to concepts of how things should behave and look like.
Yes, because you wrote about precision engineering. And could you elaborate on what precision engineering entails?
Yeah, so precision engineering is basically the engineering of very small objects. So you have like civil engineering, then you talk about objects in the range from meters to kilometers. You have nano engineering, you talk about the molecular level. Yeah, and precision engineering is in between there. So you talk about accuracies of objects in the range of micrometers and the ranges that are needed for the hardware that flies on satellites. So you need those accuracies in mirrors and all kinds of materials. Yeah, that's the field of precision engineering. So looking at that sky, I think it just triggered me to know more about it. So you get curious and you see things in the sky. You see meteors in the sky. Then you start reading about it and you become very fascinated. Yeah, there is a little light that switches on inside of you thinking, okay, I need to know more. And I think another aspect is that what still fascinates me is when you look at stars, even on a cloudy day, when you see just one star and you have to think, okay, I see a light that comes from such an incredible distance. And I see that with my own eye, with my mathematical background. I need to calculate, okay, what is the distance? How much light is entering in my eye? So how much light is this star producing? And you reach these enormous numbers. And yeah, just the fact that we are humans and we are the way we are with all our capabilities, that we have eyes and ears and nose. And those eyes, they can see those stars. I mean, I started thinking, is that preconditioned? I mean, is that because it could be an alternative universe where light would have a different behavior that you couldn't see them with your eyes. And then we would live in the dark. We couldn't see those stars with our own eyes.
Oh, wow.
And it could be like that. And it's just the fact that we can actually see them.
Super fascinating. So when you describe this process of seeing these stars and then starting to calculate how far the light must have been traveling, it's like turning curiosity into mathematics. And I wonder what role, because this curiosity and fascination and imagination It triggers a feeling of wonderment. For me, but this is personal, mathematics is something opposite to wonderment. But that's maybe because I'm not really that good in mathematics. So how is wonderment associated with imagination?
For me, it's the opposite indeed. Like mathematics, that you have to run the numbers and there is like a beautiful moment that you also calculate and you find out why you can actually see those stars. It is in the numbers. You can work with how big is your eye, the diameter of your pupil, how many photons this star is putting out, the distance. And you can also start to calculate, okay, yes, I can indeed prove that I can see that star. And that's the nice thing of mathematics, I think. It puts a way of looking at things that is like independent of the individual. That is, I think, one of also fascinating things of human nature, I think, that has developed. And that we're capable of putting something in a mathematical formula that is transferable to other people. And that every time people check it, it works. So there is a real truth in mathematics. There is only one solution. There is only one truth. And that's, what I like about mathematics. That's just,
So there
I don't know
are...
if I answered your question, but
Okay. Yeah, no, you did. So I was thinking there are these moments of, when we talk about wonderment, there are these moments of wonderment in realization through mathematics.
Yes, exactly. So that there is the wonderment from that. What happens also is that you see something and you start to run the numbers and you find out that there's a controversy, that you don't find what you're looking at.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have to look again and you have to run the numbers again and you look at errors and you look at other ways of explaining things. So that also brings you closer to the truth that you might have forgotten something, you might have forgotten an effect. And that's the scientific process, I think, to find the truth. And that whole process is also the fascinating process, I think, that to really crack the puzzle.
Yes. And to crack this puzzle, there are different tools you can use, among other math experiments, laboratory work. But essential to understanding science is imagination. And before we can move further through the role that imagination plays in your work, could you please give me a definition of what you consider as an imaginative act? And please note that there, in philosophy, there's not a sufficient and definite definition of what imagination is. So it's still a debate.
So for me, imagination, I put it in the context of mechanical engineering, and that's the field of designing objects. For example, a satellite, I mean, there is like 20,000 components in that satellite, and together they are the satellite. So every component has a drawing, they have a mechanical drawing. And before the drawing is going to the manufacturer, then there's lots of design before you make such a drawing. And I think the whole process before you make drawing is imagining. Before you can think about a mechanism that you want to use on the Mars lander, it starts in your head. So that this whole process of thinking about how this object should look like, I think that's imagination for me.
And the imagination on the drawing table is constrained by data.
Yeah, I mean, exactly. You can imagine certain objects, but when you put them on a drawing and you say to a manufacturer, please make this object, this manufacturer can sometimes say, here you want something impossible. So there, the imagination hits the reality.
Yes.
You have to bring that back into your process, your imaginary process, that you have these constraints.
Impossible or maybe not possible yet.
Yes, exactly. So and there's interesting discussion also there that sometimes people say, this is impossible. Mm. And then later on, it proves to be possible.
Yeah, you are working with data on a daily basis. You're used to working with data. And we briefly discussed also the role of mathematics. I'm especially interested in how imagination and working through a thought experiment, for example, where you have certain conditions that you work through an experiment in your head, how this experimental space of imagination is employed in combination with observations and math.
Yeah.
Do mathematical structures have sufficient representational capacity, for example, to do the representational work of models? Or do you really need imagination to comprehend these big, big numbers?
Yes, I think so. I have one example of my work that I did more than 20 years ago at ESRON, at Space Research Institute in Utrecht. And there I worked with an instrument that was in the lab, in a vacuum chamber. And we did measurements with that instrument through a hole in the roof, and we looked at the sky. But we saw with this instrument, we saw a sinusoidal structure on the signal. Yeah, this sinusoidal structure couldn't be in the measurement of the sky, because when you look at the sky, you see the light from the sky. There is no physical process there that creates such a sinusoidal structure. So we had to think about, okay, what is causing this? What is causing this? So you get all your imagination has to kick on to think about what could cause it. Yeah, so you could say, oh, there may be an alien we are also looking at that's doing that. Well, of course, other things that could cause it in the instrument. So you have to rule out all the options that are likely not to be the case. And so in the end, we found the reason, and it's still a theory, that on top of the detector inside of the instrument, there was a little layer of water vapor in nanometers thickness that caused that sinusoidal structure. And in the end, that put in a paper, and that's now taken as the truth for being there. But that was just one of the 10 imaginary options that we constructed before we said, okay, this is probably the cause.
I find this very interesting, because could you then say that this imaginary scenario you employed for counterfactual thinking, is there validation through imagination?
Yes, I mean, what I said, one of the jokes we made is we're looking at aliens that producing, because the instrument is looking at the sky, but it looks basically billions of years away. And somewhere in that line of sight, there could be an alien producing these signals. But yeah, then you think, what is the likelihood of that? You rule it out immediately. Although, yeah, in theory, it could be possible.
It also has to do with that science tends to likelihood, elegance, and simplicity, right?
Yeah, exactly. So most of the time, it is the explanation, which is the most likely explanation.
So you worked on data analysis of validation measurements taken with ground-based optical remote sensing instruments. So what role does imagination fulfill when it comes to interpreting observations? For example, how do you know exactly which colors are present and which are missing when it comes to observing deep sky objects?
Yeah, yes, that's where the term calibration comes in. So you have the instrument that we had in Esseron in Utrecht in the vacuum chamber, and this instrument was built, and a copy of this instrument was also in space on a satellite. But we built that instrument to all kinds of specifications, so we had some idea what it would do when we integrated it. And so there is a whole theoretical model of how this instrument behaves before it gets built. And when it gets built, you start to test it and show that it is built and it does the same thing as we predicted it would do. And so for example, for this instrument, there is a helium neon laser that has a very specific color. So if you put that laser in front of the instrument, you know what the color is that's going inside of your instrument. And when you see on the detector where that light is being imaged, and you know that the light is traveling through the instrument to the detector to a certain pixel, that, and you can say this pixel is now looking at this wavelength, this color. And you do that for a number of those colors, other lasers and other light sources. And therewith you just calibrate the instrument, and you at some point you know exactly which detector pixel is looking at which color. And if you then just place the instrument and look at the sky, you already know that which pixels look at certain colors, and you say, okay, the sky has this intensity at this color.
Yeah, you mentioned in the very beginning that you wondered if us seeing these stars with our naked eye is something that might be preconditioned. And I was just wondering, this calibration is done by us, so we can never surpass the human perspective on the universe.
Yes, yes.
So there might be still colors, things that we are missing. Of course, instruments give us an extension of our senses. But in a way, do you ever wonder that we might miss some very important things?
Yeah, yeah. Well, that's a fascinating observation. I'm sure that if you see, especially in all kinds of telescopes that we send to space, if you compare how much light those telescopes can see, both in terms of the amount of light they can see, because they have such big telescope openings, and the human eye has just a small pupil. The Hubble Space Telescope has basically a pupil of 2.4 meters. So much more light can reach into the eye of Hubble Space Telescope than can reach in our own eye. So that's one thing. So if our eye would be even bigger, we could see much more. But also in the terms of colors, yeah, the human eye can only see from about 350 nanometers to 800 nanometers. That's the UV all the way to infrared. But there's space telescopes that range all the way from parts of a nanometer, so very hard UV, to very far microwave radiation of meters. That's an extension of the human capability. We will never experience as a human what really can be seen at those wavelengths because, yeah, we only know this very small visible range.
Yes.
For us, yeah.
And color is such a strange phenomena. Difficult scientific problem is the existence of color. But that's another discussion. Yeah. So imagination can also be formulated as maybe a learning by thinking process. Do you think that we can learn something new by working through an act of imagination? So for example, by working through a thought experiment, and you already gave some sort of answer. I think it's confirmative, right?
Yes. So you mean the answer of mechanical engineering, yes, that you think about an object? Exactly, the answer is yes. I also teach at the In Holland Aeronautical and Precision Engineering College. Yeah, what I do a lot with students to tell them, okay, I need you to design something, and they have to think about what I really want and what they have to imagine that the object is looking like. And that, yeah, is very, very much a part of learning by imagination.
Do they have certain guidelines that they...
Well, guidelines, no. I don't have like a theoretical framework for how to do that process. And I could not really explain how to do it, because it's so much part of your own way of thinking, how you approach a problem or how you work, basically.
So this thought process of creating new devices, it's very much so an interdisciplinary approach. Learning by imagination is, in my opinion, an interdisciplinary approach to science. And speaking of which, you were involved in a project with art students of the Willem Koning Academy in Rotterdam called Space as a Metaphor. What was this project about?
Yeah, so this project, I do this basically yearly with the Willem de Koning Academy, with the students of Nick Verschoor. And he's one of the teachers there, but he's also an artist himself. And he did many, but he's like fascinated by space. So that's our connection. And yeah, he yearly has this program to look at space as the place to do art, to think about what are the constraints, what's the freedom you have in space. And so on a meta level, he basically teaches them, okay, on Earth, you have society. When you want to do some art piece somewhere, there's all kinds of constraints. You have to go to the municipality to get a regulation, to build some art piece and to put it somewhere. You all have these earthly constraints. But in space, there is like international treaties. But basically, it's a no man's land. You can go there and do whatever you want. I'm not advocating for it, but... It is basically the land of the free. It's like the new America, so to speak, with unbounded freedom. And so that is basically the starting level for the student to think about, okay, what can you do in space when you're totally free? I mean, the results were very interesting. I mean, basically all reflected on the life on Earth. So they couldn't really let loose of planet Earth. It was all in relation to planet Earth. So that's, again, our conditions as a human, that we are bound to planet Earth. And it's a very important constraint for our being and also for our imagination.
You mentioned that space is a no man's land. It could be my algorithm bubble, but I noticed that there are designers, scientists, philosophers talking about the ethical implications on space travel.
Yeah.
Do you think that we need to talk about space ethics?
I mean, I remember I went to International Space University, ISU.
Yeah.
And that's like, that's in Strasbourg. And they have like a year, every year they have a summer school. And I went to the summer school back in 1998 already. And 2 years ago, it was in the Netherlands at the TU Delft, this summer school. This summer school is also about interdisciplinary approach of space activities. And ethics is also one of those disciplines that is being taught at the International Space University. And while my background is more in engineering, I certainly find it very interesting to talk about these ethical questions. For example, with Mars, do we have the right as humans just to go there and set foot on Mars? Do we have that right? As it is now, no man's land. There is, of course, the Outer Space Treaty from 1967, where it states that nobody can say, this is my land in space, where on Earth we have sovereignty for all kinds of states and actors, that on Mars, yet you cannot claim sovereignty of the Martian surface or of the lunar surface. But it's just in a treaty. If you go there with a bunch of people and you say, this is my land, who's going to stop you? Yeah, people on Earth will say, oh, that's not possible because there is this outer space treaty. You're not allowed to say this is your land. But then then you just say, I don't care. I'm here on Mars. This is my land. Come throw me out.
yeah. But is this what happening with SpaceX?
Yeah, that's a bit of the threat in the discourse, I think. Personally, I don't think that's really, really a threat. I mean, Elon Musk, he's of course a fascinating figure. And I actually met him back in 2004 at the Congress when he was still starting up his SpaceX company. And he was laughed at behind his back because he was a rich guy. People in the space industry, okay, all these rich guys, they will all be broke in a few years. And many of them actually were broke after many years. But Elon Musk not. He went on and he did it. And he has now the most reliable launcher on the market for space. Mm-hmm. Yes, yeah. And the most cost effective. So he really made a huge stride in the access to space. I really applaud him for doing that. He also has this project called Starlink, where he wants to put 42,000 satellites in orbit to create broadband internet everywhere. And 42,000 satellites, I think that's not good. That should be limited to some. I mean, he has now 1,000 satellites in orbit for this Starlink system. I think the limit should be somewhere in like 2,000 or 3,000, not more.
Why does there need to be a limit?
Well, there is like, if you put something in orbit around Earth, there is vacuum, and this object will circle Earth forever. So it doesn't stop. And if you put more objects in there, you get at some point, you get collisions. And those collisions are very high energy. I mean, you can have collisions of two satellites, each traveling 7 kilometers per second. If they collide head on, you have a collision of 14 kilometers per second that shatters those two satellites in a million pieces going in orbit again.
It's already happening, isn't it?
Yeah, this happened back in 2007, I believe. There was a collision between two defunct satellites, or one active and one defunct satellite. Yeah, so these things happen. But at the moment, there is no problem with that. I mean, there is so much space in space. Yeah, those collisions don't really harm the safety of astronauts on board the International Space Station or harm other satellites. We just have to steer away sometimes from other satellites. But if you now are going to put 42,000 satellites in there, I mean, you could go to the so-called Kessler syndrome. And that syndrome is basically when you cannot control anymore the amount of collisions that take place. So each collision produces new parts that produce collisions that produce new parts. And at some point, you get this exponential growth of objects. One little paint flake traveling at 7 kilometers per second can destroy an entire satellite. And so if that goes on, you get what they call the Kessler syndrome. And we have this huge cloud of particles that are going very fast, and you can basically not go out anymore, because if you travel through that cloud, you get hit and you're done, and that must be prevented. I mean, that's far away still. I mean, that's not, even if Elon Musk put those 42,000 satellites in space, this is not going to happen. Like,
but it's important to stress that's not a really likely scenario to happen anytime soon, but it could become a reality. And I just read a paper about a Japanese company who is actually creating wooden satellites to help clean the space debris. They want to launch it in a few years, I believe.
Yes, that's correct. I lost the name, but I know Astroscale, I think they're called. And they have the plan to remove orbital debris, what they call it, and to remove satellites from orbit.
We are already thinking about solving future problems, which is actually, I think, a good thing. But I'm really missing the ethical discussions about space, about ownership in space. And earlier, I spoke with Nancy Vermeulen, among other, about SpaceX and how SpaceX opens up possibilities for commercial space travel. And Nancy is an astropreneur, and she sees a lot of possibilities. However, I also spoke to Professor Vincent Icke, who thinks that SpaceX is just a bunch of, and this is rephrased, of space cowboys. And both have very different points of view, but both believe that space research can do a lot for us, mankind here on Earth. And both believe that our psychology, so our mindset, first really needs to change before we can settle on the moon or Mars. Personally, I'm a bit skeptical about the increase of space travel and institutions like SpaceX, because it sometimes almost seems that we want to change the scenery instead of to change our mindset about taking care for our planet. What are your thoughts about commercial space travel?
Yeah, so I think there's a misconception about Elon Musk. I mean, he's in the media, he said, okay, we have to go to Mars to colonize, and he wants to bring humanity to Mars. And people mistake that a bit by thinking, okay, he wants us all to go to Mars, and he basically says Earth is lost and in lost cause. I mean, there is an interesting interview somewhere on YouTube to be found that where he really says the opposite. He cares a lot about Earth. He just wants to expand humanity to Mars, and he doesn't want to basically leave Earth in the shambles. Yeah, because it's also impossible if you look at the amount of people on Earth, how many people he could transport to Mars if his plans will work. It's completely infeasible to think that can transport the entirety of humanity to Mars. I mean, there's people saying, oh, why go to Mars? Eh? Because we have so many problems here on Earth to solve. Let's say, okay, if space is the problem, that going into space is the problem and preventing us from taking care of Earth, I would be fully agreeable to say, let's stop all space activities, okay, and with the money that is freed up, solve the problems on Earth. But if you do the math again, you will find very soon that it's not the problem. If you look at the expenditure of space activities, and the biggest space activity, you could say, is by the NASA, they get about $20 billion a year. The United Space Military gets about $700 billion a year. So that's like 35 times more. So if you say, okay, let's cut this $20 billion because we're going to solve all the problems on Earth. But I mean, go ahead.
It's very easy to aim your arrows at SpaceX because they are really out there. And my question is it something that can exist next to each other? Is that what you're saying? We can do space travel, we can explore space, but still we have a lot of work to do of taking care for Earth.
Yeah, I mean, in my world, in my mind, that can be done, like exactly what you say, to do both things, to do space and to solve the problems on Earth. I do also follow your line of thought, saying, okay, if so many people believe that we should not go into space before we solve the problems on Earth, if so many people believe that, and in the end, those space programs, they are taxpayer-funded programs. And if all taxpayers believe that, if that is the reality, then I can understand that things get delayed to go to space, to go to Mars, for example. I mean, technically, we could have been on Mars with humans. We put priority on that in the 70s and 80s, that could have been done. But clearly, we didn't do that as a humanity. We put more emphasis on doing wars all over the place. Mm-hmm. We found that more important.
Yes, and speaking also of wars, there are world leaders that think alien life forms do already know of our existence, but they wait to get in contact with us. What's your opinion?
Yeah.
Science meets science fiction here, right?
Yeah, exactly. So there's aliens out there that are observing us and saying, okay, these humans, they're not worthy yet of connecting to.
Well, I don't want to feed any conspiracy theories.
No, I mean, I don't see a reason why they, if they would be there observing us, why they would wait for something to happen here that we are suddenly better humans.
Well, that's a good counter argument. Well, thank you so much for sharing your thoughts. Before we say goodbye to our listeners, I want to ask you if you might have some books, series, or other podcast that you would like to recommend.
Yeah, so in terms of podcast, like you said in the intro, there is the Space Cowboys podcast on BNR. If you want to learn more about space and also all the things that are happening, you should really listen to that that podcast. Yeah, in terms of movies, I would like to recommend Contact with Jodie Foster. I don't know if you know that movie. Yeah, it's a fascinating movie. It's about making contact to extraterrestrial beings, but it's done in a very scientific way. Yeah, of course, it's a science fiction, but they put a lot of science in there. And it's nice they do things at the Arecibo Space Telescope in Puerto Rico that recently collapsed. There's a lot of filming there. I think the nice thing is the word contact, and we need that this year very much, I think, so people can be happy again without this pandemic.
Thank you. I will share the links and notes on the website. Last question. Who would you like to recommend to be my next guest?
Your next guest? Yeah, I think we discussed the art with Willem de Koning Academy. So there is Niek Verschoor. I think he would be an interesting guest to talk to. He has a much deeper understanding on art and space.
Nice. Thank you. Okay,
you're welcome.
For more information, show notes and links, please visit scientificimagination.org. Scientific Imagination is part of the Future-Based platform. For more information, visit futurebased.org. In the next conversation, I will talk to two analog astronauts, Charlotte Pauwels and Sabrina Kerber. Stay tuned!